To badquaker.com podcast. Today is, Wednesday, March 28th, 2012. This is podcast number 125, and my name is Ben Stone. I have a little bit of follow-up to do from yesterday. I have this tendency, and my regular listeners might, this might be like completely Mr. Obvious speaking here to my regular listeners, but I have this tendency. I have a tendency to kind of ramble a little bit and start slow and maybe beat around the bush and not really get to my point. And then after talking for about 45 or 50 minutes, then all of a sudden I realize that I'm about to run out of time. And so I start cramming all my information into the last 10 minutes. If you notice that I do that and you think that it was intentional, yeah, that's what it was. It was intentional. No, in all honesty, I don't intend to do that. I intend to sort of space things out and move through them methodologically and systematically and cover one thing at a time completely. But what I tend to do instead is I ramble around and lose my topic and come back to it, and then eventually in the last 10 minutes, I panic and try to cram it all in. And because of that, sometimes I don't get to some of the key points. So today I want to start off by touching a couple of key points that I wanted to talk about. Now, the primary thing from yesterday, and I just cut myself mid-sentence there, I wanted to finish the key points that I didn't get to yesterday. Now, the main thing that I was talking about yesterday was the overall idea that we in the Liberty Movement need to be vigilant and recognize when con artists, scam artists, different people come into the Liberty Movement with less than honest motives, or when people come into the Liberty Movement with entirely honest motives, but are seriously mistaken on some things. And we need to be able to guide the mistaken to bring them into the Liberty Movement completely, and we need to recognize the scammers and the con artists, and we need to deal with them less kindly. So that was the main point of my podcast yesterday, was to try to encourage people in the Liberty Movement to take a more active role in really looking at these people that come to us with how do I say it, from the outside, and really see what their motivation is, what it is they're selling. Are they honestly just trying to be part of us? Are they just putting on a hat and pretending to be part of the team? You know, really, who are these people that are coming in? And I mentioned several. I picked on Bob Barr a little bit, and I talked about a couple other people, and I hit the Thrive Movement, and I talked right at the very end. It had been my intention to cover a couple simple questions that the Daily Bell could have asked, what's his name, Foster Gamble from the Thrive Movement, a couple simple questions that the Daily Bell could have asked him that could have cleared up the question of who are these people and what's their goal, what are they up to? But the Daily Bell didn't do that. I'm really disappointed in that article with that interview with from the Daily Bell with Foster Gamble, because they just really threw softball after softball at Gamble and really treated him with kid gloves. It really causes a lot of disappointment in my heart with the Daily Bell, because I've had such a high opinion of them in the past, and to see them deal with this situation so poorly, it was very difficult. Now, so before I get into this too much, let me just make clear what I think about Thrive. Now, I can't say for absolute certain what is in the heart of any human being. Sometimes I'm, you know, a person self-examines as much as they can, and they still can't even entirely tell what's in their own heart. So I can't even guarantee what's in my own heart, although seeking, you know, self-searching and trying to find my own motives is a very important thing. I believe that an individual should do that. So I do seek within myself and try to ask myself what my motives are and why I'm doing things and you know, why I've acted in ways that I have at different times. So self-searching is good, but searching another's motives is near impossible. So I don't know what the motives are of Foster Gamble, and I don't know what the motives are of the other people involved with the Thrive movement. I can look at their website. I'm not going to watch their movie. I have better things to do for that kind of a time frame than to watch something like that. But I look at their website. I go through the whole thing. I shouldn't say I'm not going to watch their movie. If I could sit down and talk to Foster Gamble and he could answer my questions in a reasonable way, then it might be possible that I would view the movie, but in all likelihood, it would only be for the purpose of taking it apart, like I have the Greenbacker movies, and you know, it wouldn't be for the purpose of actually trying to learn something from it, because I find it highly unlikely that that the Thrive people are, well, okay, so let me just make my accusations. Here's what I think about the Thrive movement, and here's what I think about Foster Gamble and his little collection of people. I think they're one of two things. I think they are either a collection of con artists attempting to scam a variety of groups, not just the Liberty movement. I think either they are one of two things. They are either a group of con artists attempting to scam a wide group of individuals like the Liberty movement, like Greenbackers, like the New Age movement, like many of these separate groups of people. Either they're attempting to con all those people at the same time, that's one, or two, the Thrive movement is simply an updated version of limousine liberal guilt with a big net approach. Now, if you're not familiar with the idea of limousine liberal guilt, this would be where someone has had a silver spoon in their mouth all their life. They have either they were born unbelievably wealthy, or they did almost nothing and stumbled into vast wealth. This is very frequent among Hollywood types and among sports figures. In the tech industry, in the early dot-com bubble days, there was a lot of that kind of thing. It's where a person obtains a lot of wealth and then feels really guilty about it. And because of that guilt, they tend to take on a variety of liberal causes to alleviate that guilt. Of course, it's beside the point that they cause more harm than good when they take on these liberal socialist projects. That's entirely beside the point, because the point is not to actually do good. It's to feel like they're doing good. And that's the hallmark of the limousine liberal, is to alleviate their guilt for being rich and their be able to, so that they can feel like they've done something, whether they actually do anything or not. Sort of, you might label it the Angelina Jolie syndrome, although that would just be picking on one individual in a myriad of these people. So I believe it is one of those two things. It's either just clearly a scam, or it's a very naive attempt to alleviate guilt by some very, very rich people who have just throwing out a big net to try to, throw out a little bit to satisfy the Liberty people, throw out a little bit to satisfy the socialists, throw out a little bit to satisfy the Greenpeace people, throw out a little bit to satisfy the New Agers, and a little bit to satisfy the UFO researchers. And, you know, I'm surprised there's not a whole section in there catering to the Loch Ness Monster researchers. But it's one of those two things, I'm convinced. A scam or just an updated version of the limousine liberal guilt. Now, here's one thing that I noticed from the actual interview with the Daily Bell. There's one point where Foster Gamble says, this was the movie I wanted to make since college. Yet, there's another spot in the interview where he says, when the interviewer from Daily Bell asks him how he came to the position of believing all these things that he believes, and he says, well, my son, Trevor Gamble, was the one who introduced me to the key elements of conspiracy and how money really works, and finally, the whole perspective of liberty. Now, it's kind of funny. This is a weird time scale that he's playing with here. He had the idea of the movie in college before he had any idea what the movie was going to be about or any of the so-called liberty aspects of it or the financial aspects of it. Very interesting. Okay, now let me get on to some of the things. Well, let's do it this way. I said that the Daily Bell could have settled these questions with just a couple simple economic questions. They could have clarified all of this because if you look around on the internet, there are a lot of people asking, is the Thrive Movement socialism? Is the Thrive Movement some kind of environmentalist wacko thing? Is the Thrive Movement greenbackers? What are these people? What are they up to? What's their... I'm not the only one asking those questions. So the Daily Bell could have solved at least the economic questions just with a couple simple clarifications. Had they done so, I wouldn't be spending two podcasts talking about this. So let me give an example. They say on their website... they say that a transition to a voluntary society through election and campaign finance reform. That's what they want. They want a transition to a voluntary society through election and campaign finance reform. Very noble. Very noble. A little silly, but very noble. So basically, they want to do exactly what people have been doing for the last couple hundred years, and they're hoping to get a different result, right? Is that what they're doing? How's this been working out so far? All these people who think all they have to do is have some campaign finance reform. Oh boy, campaign finance reform. Well, you know what? The senators will jump right on that, and they'll push that through the Senate because they like campaign finance reform. Every couple years, we have campaign finance reform. And then the next thing you know, the House jumps right onto that. They need that campaign finance. We need that campaign finance reform. Absolutely. Who would be against campaign finance reform? Real specific there, Foster. Campaign finance reform. What does that mean? Has this slow transition ever worked? Ever? Has the state ever... Have people ever been able to gradually shrink the state back to a manageable size? Well, this is another phrase that they say on their website. They say, stage one, bring integrity and healing to our current condition. Stage two, limiting government control to the production of individual rights and commons and the commons. And stage three, living solely by voluntary cooperation, rules but no rulers. Oh boy, the anarchists love that, don't they? Let me read that again for you just to make sure we understand it. Plus my reading is not so great, so bear with me and I'll try it again without a stumble. Stage one, bringing integrity and healing to our current condition. Stage two, limiting government control to the protection of individual rights and the commons. Stage three, living solely by voluntary cooperation, rules but no rulers. Ah, isn't that lovely? You know what, if we could limit government, if we could actually do that, why would we need to progress to the next step and eliminate it? If government could be limited the way that statement says, if we could bring integrity and healing to our current condition and limit government to the protection of the individual rights and the commons, whatever that is, if we could do that, why would we need to eliminate government altogether? How many anarchists out there would be able to stand up, hold their fist in the air, and scream, "No rulers," if everything in the world was perfect and lovely and rainbows were everywhere and butterflies were everywhere and government was not oppressive? If government was not oppressive, why would we need to eliminate it? If we could bring government down in stages by just simply enacting this campaign finance reform and through elections, if we could get government in control through elections and campaign finance reform so that we had integrity and healing in our current condition, and if we could limit government to the protection of individual rights and the commons, wait, what? If we could do this, why would we need to eliminate government? There's something blatantly self-contradictory here. Let's take this to the slavery question. Let's say it's, 1855. And let's say some people are saying slavery in North America should be eliminated. Canada has already outlawed slavery. Mexico has outlawed slavery. All of Europe has outlawed slavery. Why does the United States still have slavery? And some would say, well, we need to transition away from slavery. We need to take these gradual steps away from slavery. Or you could just eliminate it. Oh, no, we can't do that. We can't eliminate slavery. But if it's immoral, why do we want to continue it? You see, this comes down to the very nature of the seriousness of the real question at hand. Is the state morally acceptable? Is it morally acceptable to have an institution that has a monopoly on aggressive violence? And is it acceptable for that institution to use aggressive violence to support itself when no one else in society can? If that's not morally acceptable, then why would we accept a little bit of it? That's like saying, well, I don't want rabies, but I'll take a little bit of it. I don't want cancer, but a little bit's okay. You see, it's either right or it's wrong. It's either right to aggress upon someone and to force them to do what you want them to do, or it's wrong. And if it's wrong, you need to stop. And that's the problem with government. If you think we can slowly reduce, through using the means of government, to slowly reduce government, then you've learned absolutely nothing from history. Because it's never happened once. Look, take a look. The state started out in tiny little governments in scattered city-states here and there. And it grew, and it became more and more powerful and more intrusive. Until eventually it took over whole geographic regions and whole continents. And eventually, where we are today, governments under the guise of the state have almost taken over every square inch of the earth. And it has never backed down. It has never lost its original direction. And you think that going in and just getting some campaign finance reform and maybe everyone voting, is that going to really fix government? Is it going to bring government down to where government is suddenly going to be all fun and happy and no more aggression? It's never done that before. Why would it do it now? Okay, so now, I still haven't got to the questions, the economic questions that the Daily Bell could have asked. So had I been doing the interview for the Daily Bell, I would have had the Thrive movement or whatever. I would have had their website up, and I would have scrolled across the top of their website, and I would have found that section of their website that says the 12 sectors. And then I would have dropped into that 12 sectors into the heading of economics. And I would have looked at this section in their website under the 12 sectors under the heading of economics. And I would have noticed the grand abundance of Bill Still videos in there. Now, no matter all the Mises, Rothbard, Ron Paul, Stefan Molyneux name dropping, no matter all of that nonsense, why is it that when you go to their website and you go to the 12 sectors and you go to the heading of economics, that the socialist greenbacker Bill Still is given the prominent position with all of these Bill Still greenbacker videos? If these people, as they proclaimed to the Daily Bell, grasp Austrian economics, then why do you have a socialist like Bill Still with his greenbacker nonsense as your primary person in your economic sections, in your economic section, excuse me? Now, in addition to Bill Still, there's a variety of other people there. I'm gonna butcher this poor guy's name. I apologize. I'm not very good with names. But Rinaldo Brutoco, I believe. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing the name. But this clown is a big supporter of the carbon taxation. He's one of them. Now, this guy has been very prominent and very instrumental in trying to get carbon taxation. He's the economic guru you want to listen to. You don't have somebody like Mises, Rothbard, Hayek, Hoppe. You don't have any of those on your economics section. But you have this guy who wants to push carbon taxes on us. You have him in your economics section. And then you have this, the whole page is full of Bill Still, who is, like I said, a socialist greenbacker. You have this Rinaldo Brutoco, who is this green carbon taxer. And you have the rest of the page is made up of corporate insiders, Bush appointees, Keynesians, Chicago economists. And then you have the audacity to drop Austrian economists' names only when you talk to libertarians, only when you're talking to people like the Daily Bell, then, or over at Lou Rockwell, then you want to drop the names of Austrian economists. But on your website, on the actual page under the heading of economics, you don't have one Austrian economist there. You have all Keynesians and Chicagoans, and you have, okay, so then, can a person be a libertarian and not an Austrian economist? Well, sure, you can be a libertarian and not know anything about economics. Can a person be embrace Austrian economics and not be a libertarian? Absolutely, because Austrian economics is the economic theory that causes libertarianism to make sense. And libertarianism is the political and moral theory that makes Austrian economics make sense. So like Rothbard said, and I'm horribly butchering his quote, you don't have to be a great economist, okay? But if you're going to talk economics, you look pretty stupid if you don't have some kind of idea what you're talking about. Now that's a horrible butchering of what Rothbard said, but that's the Ben Stone version of what Rothbard said. So then let's get to the questions here. So what could the Daily Bell have asked to clarify this simple confusion about economics and about whether these Thrive people are socialists or whether they're greenbackers or whether they're true libertarians or whether they're anarchists or whether they're anarcho-capitalists? What could have been asked? Well, here's a couple simple questions. In your Thrive economy that you're proposing, in your Thrive world, in your Thrive utopia that you propose, and you can name it, yeah, I mean, you can word this however you want to make it as polite as possible. I'm just not in a polite mood. But in your little Thrive utopia, who should control the money supply? Simple question. Who should control the money supply? Next question. Who should decide what is used as money? Who makes that decision? Who makes the decision what money is? Because at times, I have to look up his name, Foster Gamble. At times, Foster Gamble has talked about real money and silver and gold and real commodity money and things like that. And then you have Bill Still on there, who is a known greenbacker and who pushes fiat money. So who should decide what is used as money? Next question, who should decide how much money is in circulation? Now, this is a key question. As a matter of fact, this is so key of a question that you can use this question to divide between Keynesians, Chicagoans, and Austrians. In case there's any confusion as to which is which, there's no confusion in the minds of a lot of us, but in case you're confused about who's a Keynesian, who's a Chicagoan, and who's an Austrian, this question will answer that. Who should decide how much money is in circulation? And the final question, who should decide the cost of money? Now, that may be confusing for some people. What is the cost of money? Well, the cost of money is interest rates. Interest rates determine the cost of money. Now, this is a little confusing because you could easily say, well, the cost of money is based on gold, or the cost of money is based on silver, or the cost of money is based on some other commodity, or the cost... No. Listen, when you buy and sell money, what you're basically doing, we're talking about a time preference in the borrowing and the lending of money. And what determines the cost of money, or the buying and the selling of money over a time preference, what determines that is the interest rate. In other words, am I willing to pay you a dollar and a half next Tuesday for a dollar today? You see, if so, then that's the cost of the money, that interest rate. But if I'm not willing to pay you a dollar and a half next Tuesday for a dollar today, then your money is too expensive for me. And this is a basic understanding of time preference. I can find something else to do with my resources that in relationship to this time frame. If the money is worth more to me now than at a future date, then I'm willing to sacrifice more money later in order to get that money now. So this is how time preference affects the interest rate. So who controls the interest rate? Who should decide the cost of money in your little Thrive Utopia? Now, if you answer these questions, who should control the money supply? Who should decide what is used as money? And who should decide how much money is in circulation? And who should decide the cost of money, the interest rate? If you have any answer for any of those other than the free market should decide, if you have a central planner telling you that a specific body should control the money supply, a specific group of people or a specific machine or a specific theory or a specific thing should control what is used as money, Or a group of people or a committee or a machine or anything else should decide how much money there is in circulation or what the interest rate of that money in circulation should be. If you have any answer for any of those four questions other than those should be determined by the market, then you are not an Austrian economist, because this is the essence of Austrian economics, is that the market controls the money supply. And in controlling the money supply, the market determines what money is, how much money is in circulation, and what the value or the cost of that money is. And if you have any other opinion on those four questions, you are not an Austrian economist. You are either a Keynesian, or you're an off-branch of a Keynesian called a Chicago economist. And there's other variations as well of Keynesian and other socialist economists. But really, that's what it boils down to. If you are a socialist, then you have some answer for those four questions other than the economy. I mean, other than the free market. But if you answer the free market to those four questions, then you're the opposite of a socialist. You're a libertarian. Okay, this would be a good time to break for our commercial. And so in about 2 minutes, I'll be right back with you and we'll talk about this a little bit more or maybe something different. Stick with me. I'll be right back. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. All right, now, so we're picking on the Daily Bell here, and we're picking on Thrive, the movement, and Thrive, the movie, and we're picking on Foster Gamble. I don't know. You know, I try not to hold it against him because of his family's wealth and everything like that, but I have a hard time saying Foster Gamble and not thinking of John Foster Kane from Citizen Kane, and that's not fair, I know, but in a sense, if my first accusation is accurate, well, not the first accusation, I said one of two things. In the beginning of this podcast, I said, I think that the Thrive movement is one of two things. It's either a scam by a collection of scam artists, or it's an updated version of the limousine liberal guilt with sort of a big net approach to try to throw out something for everybody and get everybody involved in it, in trying to alleviate the guilt of a few super rich people. Well, that kind of relates to John Foster Kane because in the movie Citizen Kane, John Foster, the character of John Foster Kane, which was based on William Randolph Hearst, The figure of John Foster Kane was sort of this this guy who, in his heart of hearts, he really wanted to do good, but he really loved being a powerful, you know, egomaniac, manipulating everybody around him. And yet, he had this powerful desire to fix things and do good and spread good things. And yet, deep inside, he was filled with this horrible, this nasty person that was hiding in there that wanted to dominate everybody. So I'm not accusing Foster Gamble of that. It's just I have a hard time with that not popping into my mind whenever I hear the name Foster Gamble, Because I don't know, other than like Foster Brooks, I don't know that many, and only old folks like me know who Foster Brooks was. But I don't know of that many people named Foster, so I apologize that pops into my head, John Foster Kane, whenever I think of Foster Gamble. But, you know, a rich, spoiled kid with millions of his daddy's money and going out trying to change the world. Yeah, that's not at all like Foster Gamble, is it? Okay, so enough personal assassination there. That would be ad hominem. Okay, now, getting back to kicking these people around at the Daily Bell, they asked the following question. The Daily Bell said, "You mentioned what we have come to believe, that the top elites intend to wipe out much of humanity. What's the schedule in your view?" Now, at this point, Foster Gamble says a couple things, and he talks around a little bit in a circle, and then he says, "In terms of depopulation, I just see them stepping up their attempts with these fake pandemics, the toxic vaccines, the chemtrails and the fluoride, the unnecessary wars, and the drones killing civilians, and the GMOs in the food. It just goes on and on. What are the chances that this is all just incompetence, and that all happens to lead to the dumbing down and sickening of, and the killing off of the human population?" All right, now let's just examine these two things here, one from Daily Bell and one from Foster Gamble. The Daily Bell, "You mentioned what we have come to believe, that the top elites intend to wipe out much of humanity. What's the schedule in your view?" Well, that's quite an accusation. If you, Daily Bell, if you are actually saying that you believe that there is a concentrated plan that specific top elites have to wipe out much of humanity, that's a pretty specific accusation. And the thing about a radical accusation is a radical accusation needs radical evidence. If I'm going to tell you the sun is warm, well, I don't have to do a whole lot to prove that. You know, it's like, go outside. But if I want to tell you that the sun is actually made of butter, a radical statement like that is going to need some kind of radical support. Not just like, well, it's yellow. Well, I mean, look at it. It's yellow. See, a radical statement needs some kind of radical support in order for you to believe it. So if you really believe that there's this small elite group of humans who intend to wipe out humanity or wipe out much of humanity, what specific evidence do you have of that? Daily Bell, I'd like to see your evidence. I'd like to see you doing a complete, concise, and exhaustive article on that topic. I haven't seen that at Daily Bell. I would like to see that. And if somebody knows of Daily Bell doing such an article, please let me know, because I have yet to see something like that where the Daily Bell really clearly spells out with specifics and evidence to support that radical accusation. Now let's turn on Foster Gamble here. His statement: "In terms of depopulation, I see them stepping up their attempts with these fake pandemics, the toxic vaccines, the chemtrails and the fluoride, the unnecessary wars and the drone killing civilians and the GMOs and the food." Boy, is there anybody that you're not, is there any paranoid people out there that you're not plucking their strings on this one? You know, let's see, we haven't included Bigfoot. Who have we covered here? We've covered everybody except the Bigfoot hunters and the Loch Ness Monster hunters. That's who you, Foster. That's who you seem to be leaving out. Why do you hate the Bigfoot hunters, Foster? Why did you leave them out of your conspiracies? Because I think we have everybody else covered. We've got the Greenbackers covered. We've got the environmental wackos covered. We've got the libertarians covered. We've got the Austrians covered. We've got the Keynesians covered. We've got the liberal left. We've got the conservative right. You've pretty much included everybody. We've got the UFO hunters. We've got the crop circle people. We've got the New Agers. We've got everybody involved in this except You've left out the Bigfoot hunters and the Loch Ness Monster hunters. Why, Foster Gamble? Why do you hate Nessie? Why do you hate the Loch Ness Monster? Now, enough joking on that. I was joking. That's my subtle little humor. But again, if you're going to make radical accusations, you need to provide some kind of radical evidence of it. Now, for example, let me just pick on the some of the conspiracy theorists here for a moment. Let's say you are a 9/11 truther. Let's say you believe that 9/11 was an inside job, and let's say you believe that it wasn't actually airplanes that flew into the buildings, that it was something else. Now, if you're going to present that, then you need to not just say it off cuff to a large audience and walk away. You need to actually present some kind of hard evidence that will cause a person to look at that and go, wait a minute, there's something there. Now, if you've got that kind of hard evidence, then you can actually get people to stop and listen. In the early days, back in 2002 and 2003, when someone would say something like, you know, I'm not sure the whole government story on the 9/11 tragedy is true, the level of ridicule that would come out was unbelievable. But as more and more real facts started coming out and more people began debunking aspects of the government story, it became easier to get real respectable scientists and respectable people to come out and say, well, this is not right, or that's not right, or there's a problem with this part of the story, or there's a problem with that part of the story. The crazy tinfoil hatters who just want to run around and make wild accusations with no real support of what they're saying, they just look foolish. But when you slow yourself down and you realize that a radical statement has to have some kind of radical support, some kind of radical evidence to support it. When you realize that, and then you calm yourself down and you start to look for that evidence, and then you start presenting that evidence. Now, somebody will say, well, if you watch the movie, there's evidence on there. Well, from what I've seen in the trailer, from what I've seen on the website, and what I've seen in this interview, and in every other way, everything short of watching the movie, they're not presenting that. They're presenting all the same old worn-out stuff without any real hard evidence to look at. Now, I'm not saying that there's not rich people. I'm not saying that there's not super rich people. I'm not saying that there's not a small collection of super rich families who would just love to control everything in the world. What I'm saying is, I don't believe any small group of people is smart enough to do everything that these people are accused of. And if they are, if there really is a small group of people so super brilliant that they can do all these things that they're being accused of, they probably ought to be our rulers. If they're really that smart, they're smarter than anybody I'm aware of, and I've worked around some pretty smart engineers and some pretty smart scientists. And I don't know of anybody who's smart enough to pull off the level of conspiracy that we're talking about here. And here's the problem. Well, you get a group of people. I've been around. The more committees you get, and the wider the group of people that get together in a committee to try to accomplish something, the stupider the committee gets. That's an aspect of why the state can't ultimately work and why corporations can't ultimately work. Because the more committees that you get together to try to take care of these things and the greater detail that they try to take care of, the worse it falls apart. And that's a very consistent thing in corporations. And it's exactly the reason why central planning won't work. Now, for all of you who are listening to this, who are libertarians, and you think you're not really buying what I'm saying right here, think about this just for a minute. If you really understand what central planning is the essence of socialism. Central planning says that a small group of people can get together and decide what's best for a larger group of people. Well, if there really is a small group of people who can get together and run the kinds of conspiracies that the accusation here is saying that these people are doing, if there really is a small group of people who have this kind of power, this kind of influence, and this type of intelligence, then maybe central planning works. And maybe we should have socialism. But they can't. They don't. They haven't been able to. As much as they might desire, as much as there might be a small group of people who would just love to rule the world, they can't, because it won't work. You can't central plan anything larger than a very small area of influence. It starts to fall apart. As soon as it gets out of your immediate realm of influence, it starts to fall apart. So it's impossible to accept the premise that socialism is bad, socialism won't work, socialism is bound to fail, therefore the state is being based on socialism is bound to fail, corporations having their structure, their inner structure, based on socialism, based on central planning, based on the same essence that the state is formed in, corporations are bound to fail because of that central planning, and yet somehow this one little core group of families have ruled the world for all these years. Well, Nikki's going to bark and break off on my rant here, so I'm going to have to pause for a minute until Nikki's emergency is over. Okay, sorry about that, folks. This is the once again I give my typical apology for background noise. This is one of the hazards of recording during the daytime here at the badquaker.com headquarters. By recording during the day, I'm almost guaranteed to be interrupted by dogs barking and mailmen showing up at the door and all kinds of other events. So I'll see if I can get back into my discussion there. So what we're asked to believe is that this small secret group of people are so unbelievably smart that they can run all this stuff and remain relatively secret for so many years. They've been doing this supposedly for thousands of years. And one of the things that I didn't attack today was the thing that's really kind of foundational to this Thrive movement, and that's the ancestor worship. I touched on that a little bit yesterday. But to go back and start saying, well, the Egyptians knew the secret, and the Mayans knew the secret, and the ancient Chinese knew the secret, and the Peruvians knew the secret, and the Assyrians knew the secret, and, you know, all that is ancestor worship. No, they didn't. That was just early incarnations of the state. No, they didn't possess any magical capabilities. No, the pyramids are not magic. Yes, you can have faith in some magical thing to assume that the pyramids were formed. Let me take this in a different direction. Having worked around a lot of really, really smart engineers, there's a flaw among when you get someone who is educated to the point of where they really believe themselves to be smart, a flaw comes in. Now, and I saw this over and over and over in advanced engineering in the aerospace industry. You have a person who's really, really smart, but if they know that they're really, really smart, then they have this flaw that causes them to think that they are so smart that if they can't conceive of how something could happen, it can't happen. Now, we would face this all the time with really smart engineers. You bring to them an idea, and if they themselves hadn't already thought of that idea, then they would just reject it offhand. They wouldn't even think about it. They wouldn't allow it to even enter their mind. They just reject it, because how could you possibly, you peon, how could you possibly think of this if I haven't already thought of it? Now, that's the problem when these geniuses start looking at the pyramids and they start saying, well, there's no way human beings could make these pyramids. No, buddy, there's no way you could make the pyramids. Human beings are practically limitless. With enough time and enough thought and enough generations of working on a problem, human beings can do almost anything. And I mean that, almost anything. You think about where we went from the year 1800 to the year 1900. You think about the technological advances that took place in that 100-year period. And then you realize that another 69 years later, we were standing on the moon. Human beings were standing on the moon. A mere 69 years after riding horses, and a mere 169 years after having the fastest transportation available being sitting on the back of an animal. And in 169 years, human beings were standing on the moon. You tell me we can't build a pyramid? You tell me that human beings are incapable of this? We have to have aliens to come and help us? Or we have to have some magical knowledge? No, I reject that outright. Human beings are amazing. And the one human being that you think is the stupidest might be the most amazing. They might have things going on in their mind that you can't even imagine. I knew, this is off, but I want to say this anyway. I knew a guy one time who described himself as a neck downer. I think he graduated high school, but I wouldn't bet on that. He, about the time he came out of high school, he got heavily involved in drugs, and he just wasted years of his life. And then finally, after almost wrecking his life entirely, he got into a good marriage with a good wife, and he settled himself down and got himself a good non-thinking job where he could just go in every day and earn a decent living. And I met this guy when he was probably, mid-40s or so when I met him. And he was just a quiet hourly worker, not saying much, just doing what he's told, working for engineers. Just very quietly, you know, something would spill, he'd go clean it up. They would need somebody to carry something from one location to the other. He'd go get it, pick it up, carry it there. He called himself a neck downer because that's what his job was. After I knew him for a couple of years and really got in to where he would trust me and where we could talk, I found out that hidden inside that person was a brilliant individual. And the department that we were working in was facing a layoff. There were, within the crew of people like him that did the job he did, there were about 22 or 24 of the people that did the same job he did. And they were going to lay off about 18 to 20 of them, maybe as little as 16, but somewhere between, say, 15 and 20 of these guys were going to, of these people, male and female, were going to get laid off. And he and I were talking about it, and when we were sharing how tragic it was that some of these people had so many years on this job and they're going to get laid off. And the whole thing is all the work that they did was going to be farmed out to a contract company. And so he and I started brainstorming. Now, here I am working with high-level engineers and scientists, and I have a full plate already. I don't have time to deal with these things. And they can all get laid off. It's not going to affect me one way or the other. As a matter of fact, if I'm involved in the work of getting them laid off, I'll probably get a promotion out of it. But instead, I started talking to him. And eventually, he and I gained enough mutual trust that we came up with a plan. Now, he couldn't present this plan on his own, but I could because of my position. So I took the plan, and I took the technical knowledge that I knew, and I took the idea that he had. And together, we figured out a way to save the company that we worked for over $800,000 a year and keep all of those employees. We saved all of those employees from getting laid off. Plus we saved the company over $800,000 a year. And that neck downer did it. And I helped. There was aspects that he didn't know that I knew, but there was a lot that he knew that I didn't know, and I couldn't have done it without him. And so that's your neck. That's the person you look over. That's the person these really smart, educated people look over. They don't think that somebody could possibly think of something that they themselves haven't thought of. So when one of these really smart people looks at the pyramids, and they look at a rock that's the size of a small, you know, car, like a Volkswagen, they look at a rock the size of the Volkswagen, and they think, well, that's it, can't be moved. Yeah, it can. All over the world, people have moved things like that, and still can today. just because you can't doesn't mean it can't be done. Now, I steered away from my notes pretty severely there, but here's one other thing that happens. I mentioned that whenever you make radical accusations, you need radical evidence. Now, that goes it's the same for the Daily Bell's accusations, and it goes the same for Foster Gamble's accusations. If you're going to say these things, you need really, you need to not just say them over and over. You need to really have some radical evidence of spraying of the chemtrails. You need to have radical evidence that this stuff is intentional. But what Foster Grant? No, not Foster Grant. That's sunglasses. Foster Brooks? No, he was a drunk in the 60s, or at least he played one. What Foster Gamble says is that, what are the chances that all this is just incompetence that all happens to lead to the dumbing down and sickening and the killing off of the human population? Well, you've presented to us a false dichotomy, Gamble. Here's what you're saying. You're saying that either all these things are happening out of random chance, and it's just a giant accident of incompetence, or a central committee of these special, powerful families are all planning all these things, and they're totally in control of all of it. And in one place, you even made the accusation that they want to control every aspect of everyone's lives, which I find highly unlikely. But you make those accusations, and you give us this false dichotomy. It has to be either this small group of families who are super brilliant, that are controlling everything, or it's random chance and just vast incompetence on every level. But you're ignoring the third option. The third option is that there's a thing called the state. And this state is made up of all people all around the world believing in such a thing called the state. And as all these people on all these levels, from the highest people in government, from the most powerful people in the world in government, right down to the lowest dog catcher, with all of them in all levels believing thoroughly in the myth of the state, and all of them on all those levels taking individual actions directly related to their belief in the state, creates a system that guarantees incompetence. It's not just random chance. It's not levels of individual incompetence. It's from the top to the bottom. When you remove responsibility from actions, and that's what the state does, when you remove individual responsibility for individual actions, you guarantee negative consequences. And that's what the state is. From the very, very bottom to the very, very top, the myth of the state creates a system that guarantees incompetence. This is not a conspiracy of a small group of families. This is not vast incompetence on the part of a bunch of unrelated people. It's a myth. It's a series of people all believing in the same myth and all committing the same follies based on that belief. And the wider this belief is accepted, the worse the incompetence gets. When there were only a few people in a few city-states believing it, it was relatively limited. But as time progresses, and more people are captured into this myth, it becomes more and more unstable and more self-destructive. That's the third option. That's the one that the Daily Bell is overlooking, and that's the one that the Thrive Movement is overlooking, and that's the one that Foster Gamble is overlooking. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening.